Is this your motto? Whatsoever you strive to do, do it with your might. Is that our motto as we run the race? You know, that's a quote for the Bible verse, Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10. And it requires self-discipline and focused faith in order to achieve great things. That applies in running a marathon, it applies in business, in teaching, in strategy, in sports competition, to do things with your might. It's especially true in Christian development. The Bible makes it clear that we can make the most of our calling, that we can endure to the end, we can be totally successful in doing whatever we want to. Do we want to, though? I hope so. I think so. Do we want to on a regular basis? Do we want to do things with our might? And when we consider the things that we could do, and there's not time to do everything, one of the most important choices we can make is to make our calling sure. To make our calling sure with all of our might. And to do that consistently. What I'd like to talk about is actually the title of the sermon, which is From Good to Great. From Good to Great, How We Should Make Our Election Sure. How do we make our election sure? We imitate those who have had faith and self-discipline. As I begin, I'll raise the following question. If God had called him into our fellowship, would Jim Stockdale have become an eminently successful Christian in the Church of God? Well, who is Jim Stockdale? In 1992, Stockdale ran as Ross Perot's vice presidential running mate, and amazingly, unlike most third parties, they picked up 20% of the national vote. Stockdale had an illustrious military career, but perhaps he is best remembered for his service to the country in Vietnam. He was one of the first people to be shot down over North Vietnam and was immediately taken to a prison in Hanoi. And for the next 7.5 years, he was in incarceration. And for those 7.5 years, he was in solitary confinement. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor, and the New York Sun newspaper wrote it up, and they referred to Stockdale's efforts as, quote, a disfiguration to dissuade his captors from exploiting him for propaganda purposes. In plain English, what that meant was he used a wooden stool to beat up his face to a pulp so that he could not be used in an enemy film. One reason that he was so admired by his fellow prisoners was that he almost mortally destroyed himself on several occasions to send the message to his captors that he couldn't be bribed or bought or tortured into confessing anything. And because he was so stalwart that way, the North Vietnamese decided not to harass the other prisoners or torture them. They thought it'd be a waste of time. They're not going to crack. They're not going to cave in. A man by the name of Jim Collins, a professor at Stanford, was very much taken by this man, and Collins was wanting to write a book on success, a corporate business success. But he thought, you know, I've been working on this book for about 5 years. I want to pay a visit to this guy Stockdale. I want to find out what all he employed in his tenure in Vietnam that made him such a success, and want to see if some of those life experiences would spill over into the success in the area of business. And so he interviewed Stockdale. And when he met him, he said to him, well, how did you find the courage to survive? And again, Stockdale's philosophy turned out not only to be valuable, as far as Collins thought, to the business world, but it was certainly a philosophy that's very important to the Christian world. Stockdale replied, when I was held captive, he said, I never lost faith in the end of the story. I never doubted that I would get out alive. I never doubted I expected to prevail in the end. and turn the experience into the defining moment of my life when in retrospect, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'll read that again. He said, when I was captive, I never doubted that eventually I would get out. He didn't assume it would be a short tenure, but he thought in the long run, I will get out. And he said and added, that would become a defining point in my life, and in retrospect, I would never trade that experience. How many of us would say that about our trials? How many of us would say, I wouldn't trade my unfair or my difficult trials for anything? I think we know at this late date that God allows trials to happen to make people stronger. Sometimes we may bring them on our own, but in many cases, they are not self-induced. So again, what Stockdale said was, I never lost faith in the long-range future, but I consider this a blessing. I would not trade that 7.5 years for anything. Collins wrote, he says, well, I didn't say anything for many minutes. We continued our slow walk to the officers' club. Stockdale limping with a swinging arm and a stiff leg that had never healed from the torture, the 20 different tortures that he received before he finally stood up to the captors. Finally, after 100 meters of silence, Collins asked, well, who did not make it out of those prisons? And Stockdale said, oh, that's easy to answer. The optimists. The optimists? I don't understand that, I said, now completely confused given what he had said 100 meters earlier. Yeah, the optimists. Oh, they were the ones that said, we're going to be out by Christmas. And Christmas would come and go. And then they said, oh, we'll be out by Easter. You watch. Easter came and went. Well, surely we'll be out by Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving came and went. Oh, we'll be out by Christmas for sure this year. Christmas came and went. And then he said, they died of a broken heart. They gave up. I think, as an aside, that's another reason why it's dangerous for people to set dates for Christ's return. Because there could be disillusionment. People think they got it all figured out. We're going to have the secret rapture and this will happen and all. Well, we know a lot of things that will happen, but there are some false premises that people have, and if those don't materialize, what do? Give up? Die of a broken heart? Well, Collins went on to complete the book after 5 years of work, and he was heavily influenced by that engagement with Jim Stockdale. And his book that he completed, employing Stockdale's principles, was entitled From Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Why Others Don't. In the book, he dispels the false myths of achieving success. In the 5 years that he wrote the book, he conducted a study of 1,435 thriving companies that generated millions of dollars that people considered successful. But he identified that out of that, less than 1% made this quantum leap. There were 11 out of the 1435, 11 companies that catapulted themselves to greatness, that made tremendous profits, had a streamlined organization, that did everything right, as Collins said. And the purpose of this sermon is not to examine a book or to think that, you know, the ultimate life is to run some multi-billion dollar business. But the principles that carry over from the what they had done and the principles of a Jim Stockdale continually echo through the Christian walk, the Christian life, what we can do. We have one shot at this. We are called now. We have a chance to be able to obey God a little bit or obey God a great deal. We have a chance to sort of float along in life or to do things with our might. It's up to us. Some people go through life and they're happy with C minuses and others can't stand it if they don't get an A minus or an A in life or in school or wherever. And hopefully when we think of what is at stake and what we can accomplish here and in the world to come spiritually, that we want to do things with our might. We see ourselves as being successful, crossing that finish line, being marathon winners, as it were. To do all of that, it is not going to happen on its own. If we do the same things that those 11 companies did, our results will be extraordinarily different than they might be otherwise. One of the main features of the book was called the Stockdale Complex. Stockdale Complex, which says the following: you must maintain unwavering faith that you can and will prevail, and at the same time have the discipline to confront the most brutal facts. This is what Stockdale said that he had to do. Confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they may be, and then deal with them. The brutal reality for Stockdale, as far as he knew, was he was not getting out of jail anytime soon. Another brutal reality was he was going to have to continue in pain indefinitely. There was nothing he could do about it. He was going to be in isolation. There was nothing he could do about that. And that he would have to change and improve as a person and have some long-range vision and self-discipline in order to deal with the situation that was foisted on him. The thing that makes the Stockdale Complex so valuable is it restates biblical principles and serves as a purpose statement to this message. So again, the Stockdale Complex is you must maintain unwavering faith that you can and will prevail. That's number one. And number two, at the same time, have the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they may be, and then be willing to deal with them. So to successfully complete our spiritual race, we have to have unwavering faith and deal with the brutal facts of our realities. We go through this pre-Passover time, but it's good once in a while throughout the year to think about that. In Colossians 3, for example, it says to put on the new man, put on the Jesus Christ, Colossians 3 and verse 5. And by doing that, we would want to eliminate the old man that can sometimes so easily beset us. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. A common theme that the Apostle Paul talked about on various occasions. Here it says in verse 5 of Colossians 3, first of all, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanliness, inordinate affection, evil, covetousness, idolatry, works of the flesh, things that we know that are wrong, things that are against the law of God. And so, verse 7, in which time you walked, maybe in the past, and when you lived in them, you know, many of us have done things that we do no longer do. But now put off all of these things: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of one's mouth, lie not one to another. Seeing that you put off the old man with his deeds, now with God's Spirit, put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge, after the image of him that created him. It's interesting that the 11 companies, one of the common denominators of their success was they not only had an important to-do list, but their executives, through soul-searching and through examination, looking at the ugly realities of their life, because they didn't have perfect companies, they came up not only with a to-do list, but a stop list. Here's a list of the things we will stop doing. We will stop getting over heavy, top heavy. We will stop wasting money. We will stop allowing so many different competing departments to exist where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. We will stop having bad communication, or we'll stop having no communication. There are people that in business and understand that there can be destructive or time-wasting activities that undermine the whole operation. Or we'll stop hiring people that don't share our philosophy. Because if the bus is going in a certain direction, you want the people that are on the bus to have the same mindset. And a number of people realized when they were honest and looked at their 1,000 or 5,000 employees or whatever, they realized everybody wasn't on the same page. And it was important for them to say, we will stop doing that if we want to grow. If we want to be more productive, make more money, make a happier workplace. There are not only a to-do list for Christians, but a stop list as well. And you see some of that in Colossians 3. You know, success or the lack of it is not an accident. If somebody dies of a broken heart in a jail, but somebody else lasts for 7.5 years and comes out smelling like a rose, there's a story behind that. That didn't just happen. That's just not the luck of the draw. There are reasons behind that. Mr. Armstrong used to say, know what you're doing while you're doing it. Because everything is cause and effect through life. In Luke chapter 21, Christ said, after we take a brutal look at ourselves, we must determine that we are part of the body of Christ. In Luke chapter 21, he talked about enduring to the end, continuing like that marathon runner from Greece. Luke chapter 21, verse 36. Familiar to us, it says, watch ye therefore, pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things, trials and challenges and distractions that may come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And is said with a positive tone, a positive expectation. I don't think that God would want us to be thinking, well, I'm just hanging on here. I'm just trying to endure to the end. I don't know how long I can hold out. It's getting harder and harder. Woe is me. That's wavering. That's shaky. You know, it says in Proverbs 24, verse 10, he that, you know, faints in the day of adversity, his strength is small. I'm more taken by what example the Apostle Paul set in 2 Timothy 4. I'll turn over there. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7. Paul was at the end of his life. He knew that his time was short. He might was expecting to perhaps be martyred at that point. We were talking to people that took the tour in Rome just before the feast, and they said that if you go to the Roman Colosseum and talk to a very knowledgeable guide, he will probably be able to show you the prison, probably, that Paul and many other prisoners were in. And it was several levels underground. And the people there were in a dank cell and stale air, and on top of that, no light, no sunlight. And those people that were there for maybe a year or so on marginal food went blind. They couldn't process light anymore. Paul might have been in such a place. Again, a brutal reality, and yet he was dissuaded. He was another Jim Stockdale, or Stockdale, another Apostle Paul. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, he didn't say, I just hate being here, and it's horrible, and I'm hanging on. I'm just hanging on. I don't know how long. Well, it was horrible, probably. But in 2 Timothy 4 and verse 7, his attitude was from a different world, from God's Spirit. He writes, 2 Timothy 4, verse 7, I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth now there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord has given, the righteous judge, that shall give me in that day, not only to me, but to all of them that love his appearing. He was absolutely positive. But he wasn't hinging it on a special date or a special sign. He was in it for the long haul. The long haul, unwavering faith. And he had faced himself, and he had repented and changed and made amends with God and become a more valuable Christian. And the thoughts that he had, he was inspired to write, and God preserved them for all of us. Mr. Armstrong also, not that he is a deity, but he made so many penetrating statements. One time I remember, about 8 years before his death, he was talking about reading the book of Revelation, and at the feast, on a feast film, he says, "And I have good news." He says, "I've read the end of the book, and we win." Now that's wonderful to know, but it's vital. It's part of the Stockdale complex. You maintain unwavering faith. It's not predicated, surely till Thanksgiving. No, it is in the long haul. You know that there will be a prevailing sooner or later. And if you and I guard what's right, we're on the winning side at the end. We can know that, expect that. And that was the Apostle Paul's example. Now, what if you're in the middle of your life? Let's take a look at Daniel chapter 3, which is extraordinary. The three young lads, young adults in Babylon, that were from Judea, their names were changed to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In Daniel chapter 3, we read where they refused the bidding of the king Nebuchadnezzar, who was almighty, all-powerful, and maybe had the world's worst temper, could get incredibly angry at the drop of a hat. Nebuchadnezzar did something really stupid. He built this golden image and expected everybody to bow down and worship it. Why? I don't know. But the three lads from Jerusalem knew that was a lost cause, and they were not going to do that. And they knew that that probably would mean they would be put to death. In Daniel chapter 3, we pick up the account in verse 12. It was reported to Nebuchadnezzar immediately by other people, "There are certain Jews which you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these men, O king, they have not regarded you, they do not serve your gods, they have not worshipped the golden image that you have set up." Sounds like these people were politicians trying to get rid of the three. And they approved that message. Yeah. So, verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar spoke unto them. He knew these lads. And I think he was disappointed of all people to see them, because he liked them. "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods nor worship the golden image that I've erected here?" And he gave him another chance, which is incredible. "Now, if you be ready to hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, psaltery, dulcimer, all that kind of music, and you fall down and worship the image, then we'll just forget about what happened. But if you don't, you will be cast that same hour into the midst of a fiery furnace. And who is that God anyway that would deliver you out of my hands?" Now, maybe that inspired God to want to intervene for him. It gets under God's skin when people defiantly claim that he doesn't exist. It reminds me, maybe I told that here, that was somebody talking, an atheist was upset with people, and he said, "Well, if God exists, I give him 5 minutes to strike me dead." And 5 minutes went by and nothing happened. And he said, "Well, see, I guess God doesn't exist." And somebody else said, "No, God just doesn't respond to atheists." So, you can look at it in a different way. But verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we're not careful to answer you in this matter. If it be so, the God whom we serve is able to deliver us. He's almighty. He's God. Not only that, we're in harmony with him for the long haul. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known unto you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor accept the golden image which you have set up." And of course, Nebuchadnezzar was full then of fury, and his form of his visage was changed against the three, almost foaming at the mouth. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they should heat up the furnace even 7 times more. Every time we ever bake anything and I need to go pull it out of the oven when it's done, I open it up and I get a blast of heat. I always think of this, Daniel 3. And it's only 350 degrees. Something like that is a couple thousand, enough to melt metal almost, and very, very sobering. And so the brutal reality was that those three could have died, but they knew that it would work out in the long run, and they knew that God would be there one way or another for them, either right then or later on, or to resurrect them or whatever, that God is in control and He knows what's best and He'll work it out. But they were not rattled. They just had a calmness about them, and they could stare the most angry guy in the whole world, who is all-powerful, and say, "We're not going to do it." If it were anything else, out of respect, they would. So we go with that in mind to Hebrews 11, what's called the faith chapter. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 29. We get to the middle of this chapter, and you know that Paul wrote about Abraham, Enoch, and Noah, and Jacob, and other people that were trusting in God, not receiving the promises yet, but beholding them afar off, because they had long-range vision and confidence that God would work with them. And so in verse 29, by faith, the Israelites passed through the Red Sea. By faith, verse 30, the walls of Jericho fell down. 31, by faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them. 32, what more shall I say? The time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, and stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong. Verse 35, women received their dead to raise to life again. And then it says, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trials, cruel mockings and scourgings. Yes, moreover, the bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder, tempted, slain by the sword, wandered about in sheepskin and goatskin, being destitute and afflicted and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy of. Verse 39, all these, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, not yet, but God having provided some better thing for us, that they might, they without us should not be made perfect. And then the continuation of thought, the next chapter, wherefore, verse 1, we are encompassed with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily besets us, if we take a brutal look at ourselves, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, and for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. We consider Him, His plan of salvation, that no matter what happens, if we keep the faith, we're there with Him at the end. And that's long-range vision that carries us through a lot of short-term difficulties. It is something that we don't want to live without. These are major issues of life. One of the experiences I had was in Italy. We had a Bible study. It was strictly question-answer. And Mr. Anastasi was unable to be there for it, and so I conducted it. But it was basically like a press conference. People could ask anything. You had people from everywhere, different churches of God, people from in the church, not in the church, people asking all kinds of detailed questions about the Hebrew calendar and everything. No wonder a couple of people that I invited to come up with me chickened out. And so I'm up there. I got conscripted one other person because they set up all these chairs. So it was the two of us. But one person asked a question I thought was quite good. He said, you know, we had everything ranging from, can't we just all be united together again? And that required a lot of tactful explanation, and in some cases there has been some unification, but it's not across the board. Then we got to a question, what about people that are hung up, he says, on Bible codes and secret pet theories and so forth? He says that just seems to swallow them up, and they don't want to be a part of us. And Maybe it's calendar issues or things that are, I mean, the Hebrew calendar is absolutely beautiful. And perhaps that would be a good subject to study sometime. But to get disoriented on things where they then no longer have a relationship with God or they don't want to be with other people, there are people that can get hung up on twigs and detail. So he was saying, well, how is that? Why is that? And the answer to that is that some people are not interested in having a depth relationship with Jesus Christ. And by that I mean to pursue the weightier matters of life, love, joy, mercy, forgiveness. All of these are heavy, heavy concepts. These are the weightier matters. When I see people that are thinking, well, I think that Moby Dick has a secret message for Christians. I mean, there was a book that I did a sermon once on Bible codes and such, because it was the rage in 1 year. Just like certain pet prophecies, the Mayan calendar says the earth is coming to an end in 2012. In the fall, we're almost there. You know, they had an earthquake in Maine. You know, I think that's a go. I think we got to understand that it's all over. Well, why is it that some people will go head over heels for that? They'll run out into the desert and so forth. It's because there's been a lack of development in the weightier matters of Christianity, and so they get hung up on that. And another case, as I said, some people are looking for security. Now, who are the two witnesses? People want me to have an answer. Not you, but different people. It's natural. It's natural to want to know what's going to happen in the future. And even the angels have an interest in things that God's even revealed to man that they're not completely clear on. Over in Peter, it mentions that. It's natural to want to know about the future. It's natural to want to study. And there are some wonderful studies that people can do. So I'm not addressing that. But sometimes people want a clear, secure, safe belief system. And so it'd be heartwarming if they said, well, who are the two witnesses? And, well, it's Hulk Hogan and it's Kid Rock. All right. Who are the Laodiceans? Everybody except us. Man, don't we feel great about that. When is Jesus Christ coming back? October 29th, 2017. And if he doesn't come back then, he'll be here at least by Thanksgiving. Or at least by Christmas. Don't worry about it. Where's the place of safety? Moab, Utah. How come? Well, because there are gas stations there. 12. One for every disciple of Christ. Why? Because we're going off the electric grid, and then we'll need gas engines to rev up these we have to have gasoline nearby. If everything were in a nice, neat little package. Now, we're doing a lot of Bible study and prophecy for a number of reasons here locally, but I've been in places, talked to people, they don't want anything else except Bible prophecy, and I always wondered why. Well, this is a security blanket. We know everything that's going on. We're the Philadelphians and everybody else is a Leo. And, you know, we feel so secure about ourselves, like our little cozy cocoon, when God says, no, you're to be in the world, not of it, but to be in it. You're to do a work. You don't hear people talking about doing a work when they're worried about the twigs and worried about answers that we simply are not going to know. Not for a while, anyway. And so, life is not always a nice, neat little package. And there's never a time to have an air of superiority over other people. But rather than being involved with trivia, we have to be committed to the long haul, to the main principles of life, to the weightier matters of Christianity, which involves a desire to change ourselves, to take a hard look at ourselves, just like the wise virgins would have to do. They had oil. They had to buy and sell the oil, Matthew 25. Where does that come from? It comes from yielding to God. That means having a deep commitment to what's important. Again, he that faints in the day of adversity, his strength is small. 1970 in Fort Worth, Texas, there were a number of evangelical churches that combined to conduct a rally to invite people to come and make a decision for Christ. 30,000 people made a decision for Christ. One person followed up with addresses and contacted people and determined that out of that 30,000, only 30 continued to be registered that were continuing in that same commitment. It's easy for people to be enamored with the wrong things, to be shallow, to be enamored, for example, with charisma. Now, people can see what they want to see in charisma. Not to pick on any particular person, but let's take Hope and Change. Well, that meant different things to different people. But in the final analysis, exactly what was it? One president said, "We're going to have a great society." And here we are, 30, 40 years later, it maybe isn't so great. When you look at the crime statistics and everything, problems are greater than they were back when this proclamation was made. A chicken in every pot. Well, if all we have is a chicken in every pot, we're in trouble. If that's all there is to life. But that meant something. But it meant something to some people and something to others. And so it was a platitude. People can rally around platitudes and ethereal concepts. And then when it's all said and done, where's the beef? You know, exactly what does that mean? Am I better than I was 4 years ago? Or am I better than I was in the Great Society? Or under this president or that president? A lot of people promise things they can't really deliver. And regardless of political affiliation. But people that can be enamored, and I'll just make quick reference of this. In Revelation 13, there's the beast and the false prophet. They have conduct miracles. They have lying wonders. And millions of people say, "Oh, this is it. This is it." You know, and they worship the beast, it says. And just a handful of years later, in Revelation 17, end of the chapter, these same people turn on the beast. They're upset. Some worship gold. In a short time, they'll be throwing it in the streets. In other words, when you hitch all of your allegiance and your trust on flimsy, inconsequential, shallow benchmarks, and they don't come through for you, it's easy to say, well, forget that, forget God, forget everything. You know, people become disillusioned. The Jim Stockdales of the Bible were people like the Apostle Paul, Abraham, Joshua, Christ, Daniel, David, Noah, Job, Esther, Ruth, Anna, Lydia, Timothy, all these people, and they had a depth of conversion. They had a depth of commitment. They were in it for the long haul. They constantly changed, and they never deviated from what was important with God. When companies, according to Collins in his book, were to examine the brutal realities of themselves to change, they realized that they had too much overhead, they had cost overruns, they wasted energy, they lacked clear identities. Sometimes they had inordinate fears. It had to be changed. Sometimes change is painful. Spiritually, sometimes it's hard to accept that we're wrong. None of us like to be wrong, and none of us like to be corrected, and I think every single one of us was born with a strong will. It's part of the brutal reality of life. And then God says we got to change all that, become like Christ. It's not a natural thing for most of us. In 1971, there was some of the administrators in Pasadena at the college decided that they needed to have an outside CPA come and evaluate their operations to see if things there could be any cost-cutting measures. And they hired this person, and he came, and he shocked people. He'd walk in, analyze things. He'd say, "Well, that department's got to go. You're already doing that over in this department. We need to amalgamate these different steps. Some of that money there is being spent. It's a waste of money because it's that procedure can be eliminated by doing this and doing that. And if you delegate more, then we don't have to have all these offices here, you know, in the office facilities building. And we can delegate a lot of other things to brethren. We can do this or that. And he would shock people because he, I guess, minced no words. He moved around. And they found out his last name was Shock. He was Dr. Shock. And they felt like they were shocked. And because he didn't care. He wasn't a member. He was not interested in trying to candy coat anything. You know, he was paid to do his job, and he was paid by the job. So the faster he did it, the sooner he was out of there. And he streamlined his own operation. So he was going to streamline theirs. And so he didn't worry about being tactful. Listen, bub, this is the way it is. You know, like it or lump it. You know, give me my money and I'm out of here. So he shocked them. But they needed that information. And some other companies, apparently out of the 11, they were they had the courage of their conviction. And so they had people assess them. As this person, Collins, writes about this, he says, the surprising good to great list of 11 companies included such unheralded companies as Abbott Laboratories. Then what made them phenomenal was that they, for every dollar invested in Abbott, it was four times what you would make any on the average investment in the stock market. Fannie Mae, back at a time when it was doing the right things internally, was making 7.5 times what the average investment was on Wall Street. Kimberly-Clark Corporation, one of the 11, was 3.5 times the market. Wells Fargo, once upon a time, was very successful. They were 4 times the market. One such surprise was a Kroger company, a grocery chain, bumping along at a totally average performance for 80 years and then suddenly broke free of its mediocrity to beat the stock market by 4.16 times over the next 15 years. And it didn't stop there. From 73 to 1998, Kroger outperformed the stock market by 10 times. What was Collins found out was that there were no miracle moments, no Hail Mary passes, no acts of desperation, no charismatic leaders, no side distractions, no fixations on pet theories, minimal intellectual vanity, no wasted motion, quiet consistency. No wasted motion, quiet consistency. No wasted motion, quiet consistency. Collins interviewed a vice president of Walgreens. Walgreens was an average company up until 1975, and then a dollar invested in Walgreens would beat a dollar invested at Intel by nearly 2 times, and by 1980, an investment in Walgreens paid 5 times the dividend of an investment in General Electric. It beat Coca-Cola by 8 times and the stock market overall by 15 times. When the vice president was asked to pinpoint when the good to great transition happened, he said somewhere between 1971 and 1980. And Collins was expecting some specific delineating point where, wow, they really just put it together. But the point was they were incorporating a lot of good principles. And there was no one special month. It just started to gradually take off and was consistent. You couldn't pick a month or a week where everything revolved around something dynamic. And from Kimberly-Clark Company, they said, with us, things didn't happen overnight. They grew. It wasn't a single switch that was thrown at any one time. It was the quiet developing of good principles, changing what was wrong and putting in what was right. And isn't that true in the Christian life? When we're called, there are a lot of loose ends, and everything isn't lined up the way it's supposed to be, and we continually make adjustments. And the more we make, the better it is. And the more we get rid of what doesn't belong in our lives, the better we're off we are. And then we do that for the long haul. But there's no particular event usually that gets a lot of fanfare. Maybe baptism. You know, people can applaud and have a toast of champagne. That happens sometimes in some places. We got to participate in the baptism at the feast. It was all in Italian. A woman from Portugal, from Brazil, had moved to Italy years ago and was baptized. That was a miracle in itself. But things don't just happen overnight. Character is gradually developed. The race is gradually run. The marathon is a long race. Our adjustments are ongoing. The relationship with God through prayer and study and occasional fasting, if there's not a health issue, and meditation, those are the tools. It's always been there. That's basic, nothing new. But the gradual implementation of those is what develops depth of character, depth of understanding, depth of commitment, the commitment to completing the race, taking a hard reality check at ourselves from time to time, the proper inventory, and changing with the tools that God's given us. There's so much of that that parallels business activity. It is almost like, this is totally fictitious, but one person wrote, just picture the egg being hatched from the chicken's point of view. Or let's say from the outsider's point of view, looking at an egg. And, for example, picture an egg. Day after day it sits there, nobody pays attention to it. Nobody notices it. Certainly nobody takes a picture of it. Then one day the shell cracks and out jumps a chicken. And then all of a sudden major magazines, newspapers jump on the story, just like this was out of the Wall Street Journal. Stunning turnaround at egg is the name of one caption. Another one, the chick who led the breakthrough at egg. You know, here's the story on that. From the outside, the story always reads like an overnight sensation, as if the egg had suddenly and radically altered itself into a chicken. Now picture the egg from the chicken's point of view. While the outside world was seemingly ignoring this seemingly dormant egg, the chicken within was evolving, growing, developing, changing. From the chicken's point of view, the cracking of the egg was simply one more step in the long chain of steps that led to that moment. Granted, it was a significant step, but it was hardly the radical transformation that it looked like from the outside. There are stepping stones to the hatching of an egg. There are stepping stones to baptism. There are stepping stones to us being transformed into spirit beings. But there is that gradual effort to be closer to God, get rid of what isn't God in ourselves, and incorporate God into our lives. Companies can get distracted. This was one of the big problems with even successful corporations, is that sometimes they didn't have a clear identity, or else they would get distracted and think of other things that were important. One company decided, stepping back, and said, you know what? We've tried to, Wells Fargo Bank, we've tried to be an international bank like Citibank. We didn't have the personnel for it. We were a square peg in a round hole. We lost millions of dollars. Then we tried to be the local neighborhood bank, and that was too small of a market. So we identified our niche. We know where we're good. We've got people that match that up, and that's where we're going to stay. And there were other people that were in a particular line of work, and then they tried to add to that, and then they were it turned out to be disastrous, and it was time-consuming and laborious. Maybe one of the best examples of that is in the area of media, mass communication, radio. You see a lot of graveyard of deceased radio stations. And if you've been in a market for a long time, you'll notice that. People struggle to have a clear identity, to be good at something and stay with that. Sometimes they'll dabble, and they can scramble for identities. There was WSUN 620 on the dial. When I got here, it was country station. Then it went to news. Then it went to news talk. Then it went to sports talk. WPLA, Plant City. It was all about neighborhood activity. Then it went to talk. Then it went to exclusively nothing but 1950s music. And then it died. Q105, it was acid rock. Then it was 60s. Well, then they had to make it 60s and 70s. Now it's 60s, 70s, 80s, mostly 80s and 90s. WYNF, the pirate station. Pirate acid rock. I think it died. WLCY. What station do you listen to? The phrase that, well, no, that's phrase of pays of somebody else. WLCY was big. Everybody in YOU listened to that in West Central Florida. It was 70s music. 70s and nothing else. It died. WPLP, talk. Then some of the talk show hosts died. Then it died. There's a graveyard of deceased radio stations. You've got Scotty's Lumber. You don't hear of it anymore. It was scrambling to compete with Home Depot. Then they came up with a new formula. We'll be a dollar store in addition to selling some plywood. We used to do nothing but heavy tools and machinery and lumber, but we'll do some of that because we're sort of good at that. We're going to be a dollar store and we'll sell trinkets and some inexpensive tools. Disaster. It killed them. They folded up. Pinellas Lindsley. Same thing. Some companies have had to step back and say, are we up to date? Are we doing what we're supposed to? And then they looked at the brutal facts. No, we need to upgrade. We need to reinvent certain things that we do. Taco Bell, Dairy Queen, even McDonald's. Cash and Carry had to reinvent itself, become Sweet Bay. They took a hard look at themselves and they said, you know what? We're doing some things wrong. The competition is knocking the socks off of us. We've got to change. What is it that we do well? What is it that works over and over again? What is it that got us to the point where we're at as far as something good? What is it that has helped us to endure this far, brethren? If it's not the really great parking we have out in front, it's not the potlucks, it's not the friends, it's how much do we pray and study and meditate and fast. Is making time to be in contact with God, making time to studying, to go past something superficial to having a lasting relationship with God. That's when good becomes great. Again, I'll just itemize very quickly: prayer, Bible study, meditation, fasting. Matthew 6 says, when you pray, not if, when you pray. Mark 1:35, Christ got up a great while before the day to pray. You don't have to if you're working the night shift, but he was working the daytime, and he was really busy. And if he didn't get out there and do it then he would be running on his own power, and he would die out. He didn't want to miss the opportunity to have contact with God. And in 2 Corinthians 4, it talks about daily renewal. It's not something you do once in a while. As Vince Lombardi would say, success is not a one-time, once-in-a-while thing. It's an all-the-time thing. You don't do things right once in a while. You do them right consistently. Bible study. We've got so much material, correspondence course, reading programs, online sermons, endless literature, doctrinal papers, booklets. I remember one time dating one person at the college, and she was working in the theology department. And there was all kinds of wind of doctrine going on. And she said something that I thought was pretty scary. She says, oh, these people are complaining about that. These dissidents have these points. And she says, fine, oh, I don't know what I believe. What do you mean? How can that be? You take the time. We've got the material. It's there. If we can't take the time to prove what we believe, then surely we will probably end up believing something else one day. No need for that. You know, successful people, professionals that are good at their craft or whatever it is that they're called to do, whatever their arena of activity is, whether they're, you know, vice president of Taco Bell or whether they're running a radio station in New York or Abbott Laboratories, one of the top 11, they do the same thing consistently day in and day out. And their fundamental routines. And for a Christian, it's going to be prayer and Bible study. Prayer is when we talk to God. Bible study is when He talks to us. Meditation, fasting, to get close to God. You draw close to God, He draws close to us. I have an opportunity to do a public Bible seminar in Tallahassee next month. I don't want to go up there and do that without trying to get as close as possible to God. I don't want to fall on my face or cheat the people or miss the opportunity to save something they might need because I didn't take a day to fast about it or, you know, ask God's help. That doesn't make me righteous. It's just part of doing what has to be done. There's no fanfare any more than the cracking of an egg of a chicken. It's what you do. That was one thing that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers slogan was when they won the Super Bowl. We do what we do. We do what we do. And the emphasis was on you block best, you tackle best, and you do the fundamentals, take care of yourself health-wise, and have a good game plan and follow the plan. We do what we do. That says a lot. And it was interesting when the players were interviewed, they said that with a certain confidence and swagger. So as I bring this to a conclusion, I note that many people in life are content to settle for mediocrity. There are some that strive to be good, and there are rarely others that want to achieve excellence. It takes more work, and human nature is not inclined to try to excel. But I think there's a lot of gratification and a high reward for all of us when we can, at any age, make the most of the lives that we have. I don't think any of us want to look back for the years that are ahead of us, 5 years or 3 years, look back to this day and say, you know, I just really let that time slip through my fingers. I dabbled in the wrong pursuits. I wasted time. I got distracted. I changed what I was all about. I missed opportunities. You know, it was kind of a mediocre stab at life. I didn't have any goals. I was aimless. I don't think anybody wants to be there. And anybody, and this is one of the beauties of life, you know, one of the wonderful things of living in this country is there's huge opportunity. One of the wonderful opportunities in Christianity, it doesn't matter what we were, what we did or didn't do, it's what we can do with God's Spirit from here out. And Christ says, if you want to be like me, says, strive for perfection. Now, it's easy to say. Matthew 5:48 says, strive to become perfect. Now, that's almost unfair. How can they expect us to do that? We'll never, never quite achieve the perfection. Even their current football coach of the Buccaneers, Schiano, says, you know, the ideal is always a pursuit that's out there. We'll never quite get to it, but we're always striving, always striving. So similar to Christianity. When you find people that are high achievers in whatever arena that they're doing, they are employing the same principles. And we can many times learn from other people and other activity when we consider what it is that we can do in our Christian lives. Now let's remember then the words of Jim Stockdale, the Stockdale paradox. We must have unwavering faith in times of trial so that we will prevail, and we know that we will. And we must be brutally honest with ourselves, examining ourselves to want to change for the better. We have the opportunity with God's help to do that and to move from good to great.